Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the Anwa Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Lowther, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The Anwa Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome to NucleCast. I'm your guest host, Jim Howe, filling in for the irreplaceable Adam Lowther, who's off on vacation, we hope. We've got two great guests today from the Center for New American Security. Andrew Metrick, he's a fellow with the defense program at CNAS. His research focuses on the links between strategic objectives and operational plans, with a specific interest in understanding the implications of protracted global conflict against peer states. Previously, he worked at a small little company you might have heard of called Northrop Grumman, and before that was an associate fellow at CSIS. So welcome, Andrew. With him is Phil Shears, a research assistant at the defense program at CNAS. He focuses on escalation management, nuclear deterrence, great power war, and defense industrial base and defense innovation issues. Previous to that, he worked at a risk analysis as at Ipsos Public Affairs and served as a research assistant to Dr. Alfred Conable. So welcome aboard, Andrew and Phil. It's great to have you. I got to say, you wrote a really incredible piece here. It's called Over the Brink, Escalation Management in a Protracted War. It talks about issues related to a conflict with the PRC and how the U.S. has to adapt to, you know, the current reality that it could go eventually into a nuclear type of conflict. So I wanted to start off with a little bit. First of all, what is CNAS? I mean, you work there. Tell us about the organization.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having us, Jim. It's really great to be here, and we're glad you enjoyed the report. So CNAS, the Center for New American Security, is an independent, bipartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. Metrick and I work for the defense program at CNAS, which the objective is to inform defense policy through a variety of different analytical tools and products. We do budget analysis, we do operational analysis, we do wargaming, and we publish various reports and host public discussions that spring from those analytical efforts. So we cover a broad gamut of defense policy issues, including defense technology, like you mentioned, to nuclear deterrence, to conventional military operations. And the goal is always just to develop actionable policy recommendations that better inform U.S. defense strategy.
Which you've done here. So let's talk about the research. What was the goal of the research?
So I'll jump in. The goal sort of this research project is, so 2 years ago now, roughly, our boss, Dr. Stacey Pettijohn, and one of our colleagues, Hannah Dennis, put out a report called Along the Brink, which is looking at an aspect of this question. It was looking at nuclear weapons, the chances of nuclear weapons use in a war over Taiwan. And so we had sort of been in the space doing some work. And then about a year ago, I had a report called Rolling the Iron Dice, which was looking at sort of an argument for why protraction was increasingly likely within a U.S. PRC context. And when you put those two things together, the nuclear aspects of that conflict are just really potentially, they loom large. And so this study was really set up. I have to, you know, be very grateful for the Defense Threat Reduction Agency who funded this work to go and look at what sort of were the logics for PRC use, nuclear use, in a protracted conflict. Were there any, and how might that unfold?
Excellent. And so one thing about your research, you use tabletop exercises. And tell us about that, because you know, most researchers don't use tabletop exercises. How did that kind of help inform your thinking on this?
Yeah, Metrick, I'm happy to take that. So we, for this exercise, conducted two tabletop exercises. We call them TTXs. And they were basically mirror images of each other. They both posited a protracted U.S. PRC conflict over Taiwan about a month into the conflict. In both scenarios, China had established a lodgment close to Taipei, had established a blockade around the island, and both red and blue had expended tons of munitions, volumes of their preferred conventional munitions. And the only difference in the scenario was that we were changing who we posited to be marginally ahead. So in one scenario, which we called Spike the Ball, China's ground operations were gradually, albeit slowly and at huge cost, progressing into Taipei, presumably to undertake an enormous urban warfare operation. And so in that scenario, spike the ball, we posited China to be marginally ahead. In cold stop, it was the opposite. China's ground operations were much more stagnant, and China was experiencing greater difficulty in resupplying across the strait. Their air operations were more contested. And so in that respect, we posited blue to be marginally advantaged. And so we set up the scenarios so that at the start of the game, the players would begin right after President Xi had formally heightened the alert for China's nuclear forces. We posited that he had just voided China's longstanding no first use declaratory policy in light of U.S. continued intervention in China's domestic affairs. And he had just ordered PLA Rocket Force nuclear IRBMs to field locations and SSBMs to sea for potential nuclear operations, a clear signal to the United States for what might be to come. And so that's where we tried to capture in the first move initial player reactions to China's signal and what the United States might do to try to maintain deterrence in that moment. But what was really interesting, I think, about this game is that we actually script in the deterrence failure. And so we posit China's employment of not one, but seven low-yield nuclear detonations in the theater, targeting Guam, Kwajalein Atoll, and a U.S. carrier strike group. And the strikes are low-yield and very precise. They limit both the immediate civilian casualties and the long-term radiological effects. And then after that, we go into free play to see how the U.S. is able to prevent general nuclear war while still pursuing its conventional military objectives. And China, meanwhile, or Red, meanwhile, is tasked with continuing with its unification of Taiwan. But it becomes a much different fight at that point. The brink has been crossed. We're over the brink, as the report is called. And the tabletop seeks to examine how the U.S. responds now that that's happened. Metric, I'm not sure if there's anything you might want to add.
Yeah, no. And one thing just to sort of, you know, dive a little bit deeper of like sort of why you would tabletop or a war game and what it provides is, you know, when we're talking about deterrence failures in nuclear war, there are very few historical case studies, blessedly, or one can look at. I think at this point, the Cuban Missile Crisis and like Abel Archer have been studied to a fairly well. So they provide a way of looking at and starting to puzzle out some of the potential dynamics that would occur in these situations. So they're a really useful policy tool, but you have to kind of also be upfront about the limitations, right? Because we have people who know a tremendous deal about China, but they're not the Chinese leadership. We have people who know a tremendous deal about U.S. domestic political considerations, but it's not the U.S. you know, domestic political leadership at that moment. So they're really helpful tools, but they're just that. They're an analytic device that helps us understand an uncertain future.
Right. So I know you can't name names, but what sort of people and what level of experience did the people have that participated in the TTX? I mean...
Yeah, so it was all the people that you'd sort of expect one to find at a TTX across a breadth of experience levels as well. So it wasn't just your... former graybeards with a lot of experience in U.S. government. It was also some younger analysts who are in sort of the deterrent spaces and the China study spaces. So it was trying to create that sort of breadth of experience in terms of years in the field, because you can see, actually will tend to see very different reactions among people with different experiences. But then it was folks from, you know, who had experience in government policymaking and operational circles around the nuclear deterrence issues, you know, up and then as well on the policymaking side, in sort of the folks you'd expect with, you know, OSD and those types of experiences. And then lastly, China experts, who are sort of a diffuse set of folks who are sort of across the place, you expect them, other think tanks and academic institutions.
Gotcha. Excellent. So, so you did two tabletop exercises. You did a bunch of subsequent research. What were your key findings?
So I think our key findings are sort of, I'm going to call out three of them. The first is that there's some pretty unsettling logics behind that would compel theater nuclear weapon use in a protracted scenario. And that those logics exist not just when you're losing, potentially when you are winning, because the costs associated with driving a protracted conflict to conclusion are very, very high. And as well as the uncertainty bars on getting to that place are also very high. So there's just a lot of uncertainty around that space. So that was sort of one, is that what we posited, we found was, you know, more likely than when we started that these factors were more likely in an escalation was sort of looming there. That was one. The second is that the U.S. is sort of ill-prepared to deal with that future, mainly because the ways that we were more comfortable and had a greater degree of nuclear fluency during the Cold War and in EUCOM, SACEUR, over in NATO, that doesn't exist today within the U.S. military to the same degree, and it doesn't necessarily exist in Indo-PACOM in the same way it does in SACEUR and EUCOM. So that was two. And the third is really that there's a interesting angle here from an alliance management perspective, which we hope to pursue in future research, which is that this set of TTXs and research are really closely focused on the US PRC escalation dynamics and that dyad. But of course, the US strategy in the Indo-Pacific is so predicated on, you know, using allies and partners and building sort of a regional network of friends. And the U.S. has extended deterrent commitments to many of those countries. And in that space, you know, that seems like an interesting place for the PRC to go after. You know, can it break U.S. extended deterrence commitments? And what would that mean for the U.S. alliance structure? And in the protracted conflict scenarios where you might believe that nuclear weapon use is more likely, there's a really interesting question here, interesting and unsettling question here around what the future that we describe in Over the Brink portends for a U.S. alliance management structure.
Yeah, I think the only thing I would, you know, those I think are really one, our three core findings. The only one that I would add is the TTXs really showed the real diverse opinions that are likely to emerge, I think, in the event of that kind of outcome. And so, and this is alluded to in the report, we Metric called this the wild card of domestic political responses. And yeah, we see a lot of different reactions. We saw in one game that a lot of blue players had significant reservations about continuing forward with the conflict after China's detonations. And then we had other players in that game, but in the other games as well, where they really wanted to continue to plow ahead and at minimum meet force with force, if not greater than what they had suffered. So one of the findings, I think, is that these outcomes will depend heavily on the people who are in the room and the ideas that they have and the relationships that they have with the issue at hand and their adversaries.
That's a really key point. So we'll get to your recommendations in a minute, but you know, you talked about, you know, the Chinese military and their modernization, you know, their stated no first use policy, but right now they're doing a pretty massive modernization of their forces, including especially their nuclear forces. What are the implications on this when it comes to the U.S. trying to deter the Chinese from using and going into the nuclear realm?
So I think this is one of the like open questions in sort of the China studies field. And I would, you know, I'm adjacent to that. I would not say that I'm a China expert. I just know who the smart China people are and voraciously consume their output. Because we don't know. Is the simple answer about the Chinese nuclear modernization. It is apparent what's going on. I mean, right, you don't dig 300 holes in the desert if you're not undergoing a rather significant change in your nuclear posture. So, you know, the key uncertainty here is what Dr. Vipin Narang in his academic hat before he joined the administration discussed is nuclear postures and in those nuclear postures enabling different doctrines. And so, you know, traditionally, historically, the Chinese and their no first use policy had a, you know, minimum credible deterrent that was really designed around that sort of assured deterrence model. And you can do that with a much larger arsenal. Break. It permits you the option to quickly change your nuclear doctrine if all of a sudden you have a bunch of you know, prompt ICBMs and holes that have warheads mated, or you're doing at-sea deterrent patrols and you have like road mobile ICBMs. That is a fundamentally different, that enables a fundamentally different set of nuclear warfighting approaches. And like that's the challenge. The challenge is that on one hand, the Chinese could be completely truthful when they're saying that like right now, they're saying like we still have no first use. The problem is that like, they have increased options. And even if even if you believe them, if you took them at their word today, that, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean it's that way in the future. And that uncertainty and that sort of unwillingness to sort of be more transparent around the raison d'etre behind the modernization, I think is the thing that the U.S. and U.S. policymakers are really struggling with, because the Chinese have a track record of not necessarily of having a bit of a say-do gap. It's probably the nicest way I can say that.
Got it. So how much stock should we give to China's declaratory policy? I mean, they're saying no first use, but how should we believe it?
My personal opinion is that you have to, you know, harking back to Cold War, it's a trust but verify model. And I think the problem is that we have a very hard time verifying it and actually believing what they say. Because again, back to that say-do gap, if you believe what you were saying, you wouldn't be doing what they're doing. So that's sort of the problem. So I think that this comes back to the U.S. needs to be prepared for a dramatically different nuclear environment than even the one that we're seeing today, which I would say is dramatically different from 5 years ago. It needs to be prepared for a dramatically different nuclear environment, while at the same time continuing to, even though it is often not as fruitful as we would might hope it to be, to continue to attempt to engage with the Chinese on these issues of, at minimum, confidence building measures, because the stakes are so high here that you almost have sort of this there's a moral compulsion in order to continue to engage with the Chinese, even though it's often a less than fruitful activity.
Got it. So one of the things that you talked about in the research, which quite frankly, I found very troubling, is a thing called the conventional nuclear crossfade. And if you could maybe explain that for our audience and then talk about it a little bit, what is the conventional nuclear crossfade and how does that impact what we're talking about here?
So the crossfade is really an idea arises out of thinking back to Herman Kahn's 44-step escalation ladder. So Kahn's ladder, love it or hate it, is sort of the way that we all think about escalation. It's a process-based view of the world in which, you know, we start at peace and we end up at city trading. And that's sort of the scope of the world. And frustratingly for me is this place where, you know, the conventional options stop and then everything above it becomes nuclear. And the crossfade is this recognition that due to changes in the way that we fight conventional wars, namely around precision, range, and access, we have a range of options for doing very, very escalatory things with conventional weapons that might be less escalatory than certain nuclear options on that ladder. And so the crossfade is really that place where those two factors come together. It exists primarily within the states of a conventional conflict that's ongoing, and it's ripe for miscalculation and misperception. The example, when people sort of press me on, well, I don't actually believe that this is a real place, the example that I use is imagine for yourself for a second some sort of conventional capability that is able to very quickly destroy, you know, let's say, all of your road mobile ICBMs and all of your ballistic missile silos in sort of the like halcyon days of conventional prompt global strike. And the Russians were very concerned about this. You could see that that would be more escalatory than, say, a nuclear test at sea or a nuclear test at your test site. And those are extreme examples, but they're extreme examples to make a point. And it's about, yes, there's this crossfade area that is very uncertain. And I don't think there's been a lot of research that an attempt to quantify it or really understand those dynamics.
If I could just add on that, Metric, you raised that sort of, is that really a real place concern? And I think it's important to tie this back in some way to the stability instability paradox, which I think is really felt throughout this conversation. When you mentioned, Jim, the important elements of China's modernization, I think we're talking in this case about really the ranging and targeting of its nuclear ballistic missiles in the theater range. So the explicit ability to not target the U.S. homeland, and the explicit ability to target with nuclear weapons ships. And I think that is a obviously a far cry from the minimum deterrent that has underpinned the philosophy of China's no first use policy. But I think it also exposes and points to that real place of, you think that you've mated strategically these two countries, and that there's an idea that you have a situation where both US and China are capable of devastating nuclear strikes on each other's homelands. But then the concern is that in doing so, in creating that stalemate, you've opened this window of potential non-strategic exploitation, where the United States seems potentially, perhaps, to be very vulnerable in this theater. And I think the crossfade does a really nice job of highlighting not just how that window exists, but also can be led into by some of the conventional pieces that China is bringing to the table as well. So I've also heard that question, is this a real place? And I think, well, we've actually been talking about that place for a long time. It's the strategic stability and instability paradox, and this is just sort of how it's manifesting, I think, in the theater.
Got it. Well, good news. It's time to take a short break. We'll be right back after this, and thanks for everything.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the AMLA Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
Okay, we're back with NucleCast and with our guests, Andrew and Phil, who are talking about this somewhat troubling issue of escalation, nuclear escalation in a potential PRC-US conflict, regional conflict. So you did your research, you did your tabletop exercises, you came up with a bunch of critical findings. What are your recommendations coming out of these findings? Please lay them out for us.
So, you know, we have a raft of different recommendations. I want to highlight four of them to make them a bit more digestible. So the first is that, you know, deterrent dynamics are different in the Indo-Pacific than they were in the European theater, for a lot of the reasons we highlight in the report, as well as the changes in the nature of conventional warfare. And you kind of need to do sort of, you know, the Strategic Posture Commission was a, you know, a step in this direction, but you kind of sort of need to go back to first principles from a, you know, are the deterrent theories that we are resting on correct for this theater? And then how would you build up from a, I hate to use this phrase, bottom up review of sort of US deterrence period dot. And you should probably do that commission with a set of like actually empower a group of mid-career folks that would have a sort of senior advisory body to look at it, just because too often the commissions that we have are run by, you know, wonderful, great people, but it's often too much of the same thinking that they can sort of promulgate it. So have a sort of fresh look at this in sort of a Team B kind of way. So that'd be one. Two is to start having some discussions now, primarily with the Japanese and the Australians, about a lot of these really sensitive issues around nuclear weapons use. So in the NATO context, you know, we have the high-level group and various other planning fora where we can have discussions around sensitive nuclear issues in an alliance context. That doesn't really exist in the Indo-Pacific. US and Japan are probably two of our closest allies, period, full stop. And so there should be mechanisms by which the US can begin to engage in those conversations, whether it's on a bilateral basis or within sort of a multilateral fora between those three countries. The third is, you know, if you don't want to end up in a world where you are facing these sort of pressures for nuclear weapons use, you probably need to consider significant investments. Increasing your conventional arms stockpile so you don't find yourself in this sort of place where you're having pressure to use theater nuclear arms because you ran out of conventional arms, and have some real interesting conversations about the efficiency of your conventional weapons. So that's three. And then four is going back to stuff that Phil was talking about in terms of the target asymmetries. The U.S. needs to strongly consider how to, if we see indications and warnings, cross over the line and field new theater capabilities, specifically a small number of theater anti-ship nuclear capabilities. That's sort of kind of a hole in the U.S. theater nuclear weapons space that we sort of identify as if you believe in sort of the tit for tat retaliation and deterrence maintenance approaches, if you're in a world where you're having to counter any ship nuclear capabilities, you are going to want to have some of your own to engage in that sort of symmetric signaling, hopefully only at that stage or symmetric use.
Well, let me ask, what do you make of the current U.S. nuclear capability mix? Is it sufficient to deter and effectively respond to potential coercion from China or others?
So I think putting aside the part I just talked about in terms of anti-ship capabilities, I think that we too often get into this numbers game because it's easy to have a discussion about numbers, and it's fun, and it's fun is the wrong word, but you know, we can all have our spreadsheets with our number and do the math and do the correlation of forces. We don't often so much talk about sort of the risk acceptance part that goes hand in hand with deterrence and the calculations about potential risks and benefits that our adversaries make every day. So I think that a better question to ask is like, is the U.S. risk acceptant enough to achieve its deterrent outcomes with the tools that it has today? And I think the answer is no, but I think that's a profoundly uncomfortable answer for senior political decision makers within the U.S., regardless of party, because brandishing or signaling with nuclear arms is, you know, seen as the act of a bully and potentially doesn't live up to the greatest standards of America. And so there's this, I'm not the right person to have a discussion around that, but there's sort of this place around nuclear signaling that is really important to look at. And then on the capability side, you know, if you end up, you know, with Sentinel, B-21, and Columbia, you're, you know, recapping the most important parts of it. There are, you know, there's going to be open questions about total number of warheads uploaded in a post New START environment. So I'm less concerned about total launchers than potential warhead expansion, if that makes sense. Just given that we've deloaded various launch systems that we could potentially upload. But those are discussions that I think you really have to have after you've sort of had that soup to nuts discussion about like what deterrence looks like in a multipolar world, what deterrence looks like in the Indo-Pacific, and what the crossfade means for these deterrent calculations.
Phil, anything to add?
No, I think that hits it on the head. I think just to the early point, it's, I think, a really important question is what effects does the U.S. need to generate and cost does the U.S. need to be able to impose? And I think what we saw in our exercises was that it was very hard for blue to throw red off its balance. And the red assumes and plans in a lot in terms of the cost that it expects to take on in this kind of operation. And we saw that blue had a hard time breaking out of that set of expectations. And so to Metric's point, I don't think it's necessarily comes down to specific numbers or even a fixed kind of capability that's the golden key. I think it's about what kind of costs and effects does the U.S. need to generate to be able to throw red off its balance? And what's the best way to get you there that also maintains some stability?
Got it. So there's this whole concept, you know, before people start, you know, lobbing nukes at each other about signaling. And first, could you kind of explain a little bit for the layman, you know, what you mean by signaling? And does the U.S., do we need better options for signaling in the Indo-Pacific? Or are we in a good place right now?
Yeah, so signaling is sort of the art of showing military capabilities or other tools of state in order to convince your adversary that the costs of their actions are not worth or are higher than they have originally calculated or simply not worth paying. So like the best example that I can think of from a signaling perspective is, you know, oftentimes when things are getting hot in the Middle East, the U.S. pulls carrier into the region. That is a signal. Or, you know, the U.S. will have a Ohio-class SSGN pop up somewhere. And I believe there was actually a ballistic missile boat that showed up in Korea in the past couple of years. And that, you know, was, again, a sort of broad signal. And so that's sort of the piece of signaling that's really important. And so when you ask about, do we need better signaling options? I think we sort of know how to conventionally signal. But again, we find it more uncomfortable to signal the nuclear aspects of this. And from doing a lot of TTXs and war games, what you see is in order to signal effectively, you have to be very direct about it. And too often we think we're being very clever in sending these subtle messages. So I would say, yes, the US needs far better signaling options. And I think part of that, again, comes back to being more risk acceptant in the signals that we send in order to ensure that they are being received in the manner that we want by our allies.
Yeah, I would also add that, trying to find the right word here, I think what we also found is that these signals don't happen in isolation. These signals happen, and there are trade-offs with the conventional fight as well. And so when we're thinking about the dual-capable aircraft that are being moved out and mated with potential nuclear weapons, those are also dual-capable aircraft that could have gone to the conventional fight. And the same can be said for submarines. And so that was something that we found players having to negotiate a lot, is what are the trade-offs that you need to make in a very taxing and costly conventional fight at the same time?
Okay, so a couple of tough questions for you. First is, it's not just China we're worried about right now. There's horrible things happening between Russia and Ukraine. The Russians have been signaling like crazy about nuclear, right? How does your research apply to dealing with Russia? And also, how does it apply to dealing with a rogue state, whether it be North Korea or maybe someday Iran, if they ever get the bomb? How does your research apply there?
So I think parts of it apply, but they apply differently based on each of the actors that you talked about. And the main reason of why it's different for each of them is that all of those countries that you just named have fundamentally different conventional warfare capabilities, specifically as it relates to long-range precision strike. And that's the major difference, is that we've even seen this in Ukraine in the way that the Russian air forces have been largely unable to conduct precision strikes to meaningfully cripple Ukrainian combat capabilities beyond sort of the first echelon. So, you know, in the opening days of the war, we all saw pictures of how they pretty badly missed several air bases. And they definitely, you know, have achieved effects against, you know, power generation and other places, but it hasn't been the same sort of precise attacks that you would expect of an adversary with a robust precision strike capabilities. And you can sort of grade that down across that spectrum. Iran's an interesting case because they sort of have this like hybrid precision capability that is very taxing. And you've seen the Russians adopt parts of it. But I think that at a first principles perspective, what we've learned from Russia is that the nuclear signaling is not gone. I think, you know, we all enjoyed the 1990s. And we probably didn't realize how good we had in the early 2000s. We didn't know how good we had it. And we've sort of forgotten that this is a thing. And the Russians are sort of reminding us every time. Every week, it seems like they roll out a new nuclear exercise. So what you can learn from this, I think, is that you have to think about the dyads. So those relationships, the U.S., the U.S. Iran, U.S. North Korea dyads, independently, and they each sort of need their own sort of like deterrence puzzle to explain them, and that different factors are going to play in different spaces. And so we talked a lot, didn't make it in the report, but we talked a lot about the fact that their crossfade is not one region. You could think about there being other escalation pathways in other domains, whether that be in the information domain, whether that be in, you know, cyber, whether that be in sort of irregular action. So you could imagine a set of different escalation pathways that all have their own sort of crossfade regions that are unique to each of these actors. So I think that really what this is calling for is that regardless of which of these dyads you're considering, you have to center it around the sort of integration point of nuclear, conventional, and other tools of state power, and look at it holistically and not sort of silo them off into this is the nuclear bucket, this is the conventional bucket, this is the non-conventional bucket.
Got it. And I hate to rush things. We're coming up at the end of our half hour here. It's been a great conversation. But, you know, Adam usually closes by asking for your three wishes. I'm going to do the opposite. I'm going to tell you what my wish is. And if you could very briefly tell me how we get there. My wish is that the U.S. nuclear deterrent remains so credible that no one ever challenges it. So what do we need to do?
Ellie, you want to take the first crack?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of pieces to that, a lot of which Metric just laid out. I think a sort of counterintuitive starting place is actually looking at the conventional forces and specifically how the conventional forces integrate with nuclear ones. I think I mentioned a little bit earlier, but one of the things that we found is that there's a lot of siloing that goes off from a planning and exercising standpoint, where in the event of a nuclear use or nuclear crisis, conventional forces will be directly implicated. And a lot of the times in our research or in our conversations, we found some evidence that there was a lot of siloing of the nuclear planning over to STRATCOM, thinking, and we mentioned this in the report, that it's sort of their problem. But operating in a post-nuclear detonation theater is going to be a problem for conventional commanders. And so a lot more thinking, I think, needs to go into how you exercise and demonstrate the capacity to operate in a post-nuclear detonation theater. I think that that, A, signals to the adversary that you are taking the nuclear threat seriously. And in exercising and trying to fill some of those gaps, I think that there is potential real value in closing some of the perceived usefulness in such a strike. So I think that kind of conventional nuclear integration from an exercising and an operating standpoint is really important. And you know, everybody, I think, rightfully jumps to the nuclear capabilities, but I think that there's an integration piece that's needs to be talked about.
Got it.
I'll give you one answer. Assured calm. Assured calm, assured calm, assured calm. It is the NC3 architecture for nuclear command and control is probably the most vital part of the U.S. nuclear deterrent. It's probably also the part that's hardest to talk about, but it is the foundation upon which the whole rest of the enterprise rests. So that's something that, you know, we really need to make sure that we get right and we make sure that we believe will work every single time.
Excellent. Well, Over the Brink, Escalation Management in a Protracted War, it's an outstanding read. I hope all our listeners can go to the link and give it a go. It's really well done research and really well written and with some really important concepts that we all need to think about. So Andrew and Phil, I can't thank you enough for being here today. That kind of wraps it up for this edition of NucleCast. And just want to thank you for the great work you're doing to help defend the United States. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jim. It's good to be here.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrent Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Krunthal. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.